This meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. Hello, everyone, and happy holidays to folks post-holidays. I'm hoping everyone is well. And I note again that we have a rather small group, but let's go ahead. We're going to create a record and move this forward as we move towards conclusion of our consideration of public comments with respect to the draft rules of procedure. And I will do my best to try and speak more slowly than I normally do. And I recognize that sometimes I race along a little too quickly. So let me begin by asking if there is anybody who is on the phone who is not now listed in the Adobe chat room. Hearing none, let's proceed on. Is there anybody that would like to mention an update to their statement of interest? And again, hearing none, we can move on. However, let's do so with the encouragement that we all keep track of statements of interest and make sure that they are up to date in the system. So you've seen the agenda, and we are getting towards the end, I believe, of the consideration we're giving to public comments on draft supplementary rules. Before we turn again to the substance of some of that, I would like to do two things. Again, welcome Shireen, who is observing our group. And then secondly, I'd like to give the floor to Liz Lee to speak about the standing panel. There have been some recent developments in preparations for SO and AC participation in establishing a standing panel. And so, Liz, I'm going to ask if you would bring us up to date on that.
Thanks, David. This is Liz Lay, ICANN staff for the record. So as David mentioned, there has been some updates in terms of our efforts to coordinate with the SOs and ACs regarding the process for establishing the standing panel. As you will recall, based upon the process document that we discussed with IoT several months ago, there are certain points that require along the process that's set forth in under the bylaws that require input from the SO and AC leaders as to how they envision they will go about coordinating and making essentially coming to the decision of nominating a slate for approval by the board. So what we've done is using that document that we share with the IoT, we sent that out to the SO and AC leaders, and we've also scheduled a webinar, basically more of an introductory webinar that's scheduled for 17th of January, which is next Wednesday, 1400 UTC, to start the conversation going. And what we've expressed to them in the email that we sent out to them is that we are hoping that we can have a face-to-face in Puerto Rico to come to a basically final decision about how this process will how they foresee this process going. I think this is something that's new to them. They haven't had to coordinate across the various groups to reach one final collective decision. So this is something that we want to hear from them, what they envision, how this process works for their groups and how long that would take, because I think ultimately that input will drive how long we see this process taking in terms of the entire establishment of standing panel.
I'm mangling my attempt to get off mute there. So, Liz, thank you very much for that. So I have a question to you. You mentioned there is the likelihood of a face-to-face meeting at ICANN 61 in Puerto Rico. Can you speak any more specifically about that? Have you floated times, any particular details, or is that something that's going to unfold after this upcoming webinar next week?
So we floated the idea out, but we have not discussed and scheduled any time slot for ICANN 61. We just suggested that that seemed to be a good point because it's an opportunity for the face-to-face to discuss it. And I foresee that a lot of that will probably come out from the webinar, and if not, shortly thereafter from the webinar. We have allotted time during the webinar for Q&A, so I would think that some of these questions would come out of that.
And Liz, is there a time set aside at ICANN 61 for this purpose?
We intend to set aside a time, and we'll work with the meetings team and whatever the process is required for us to do so. And obviously, we'll coordinate with this group to make sure that this is a time that's convenient and mutually available for the majority of the group and whatever that's possible.
Thanks very much. And I would encourage us and you all on staff, Liz, to think through face-to-face meetings. And let me mention in that respect that it's my understanding that it's difficult to get time at an ICANN meeting, both with respect to a venue, you know, a room somewhere, and also with respect to getting on someone's schedule. So my caution, I guess, would be is that maybe we should think about also ICANN 62 in Panama City. And the only reason I say that is it's better to have something and not need it than to need it and not have it. Hopefully we'll have the SOs and ACs well along on the path toward establishing a standing panel by that time. But I can also envision that it could be something that would be needed possibly. And I also want to mention that if you are looking for any time or any involvement of the Workstream 2 face-to-face meeting in Puerto Rico, you're going to need to make that known very quickly. Having said that, I may turn to Bernie and ask him if I am correct in that respect and if he has any remarks about that as a possible venue or site or something like that. Bernie, can you comment?
Thank you, David. Yes, I think we could arrange for some time if we're not looking at any significant changes. We don't seem to have any problems in aligning the recommendations from the various working groups. So we may have some time, and if it's useful to bring this on, given we do have a significant community that comes to our face-to-face meetings, even if it's the day before the ICANN meeting starts officially, we could arrange to have that maybe in the afternoon and even bring in some other people. So, but if you do want to do that, I would encourage you to let us know as soon as possible so that we can integrate that in the agenda. And so that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernie. It's David McCauley speaking again. I have a few more comments on this topic, but before I do, let me ask Cavus. Do you intend, Cavus, to be speaking about this subject?
Yes, I would like to say that it is extremely difficult to organize a meeting in ICANN 61 in many subjects, in particular in this one, because I am participating in some other group, and I saw that everybody looking for have meetings, auction group, there are two meetings, CCWGEI accountability, they have meetings, GNSO, they have meetings, so it would be difficult. And also, just as a participant of GAC, I'm not speaking on behalf of GAC, we also have some important meetings, so there would be a collision with all of these meetings and should not be very productive. So I am much in favor to postpone any face-to-face discussion at ICANN 62, but not ICANN 61. However, if you want to do it at ICANN 61, it should be within the time of the CCWG accountability. Usually the meeting of accountability will finish about 4:30 and so on and so forth. You could extend that time, by some hour, 1 hour, and so on and so forth. But otherwise, it would be difficult to have a separate face-to-face meeting because you would not receive whatever you expected. That is something that I want to tell you, very, very important thing. So be careful of that and organize the situation. And about the webinar, I have also some comments. As a member of the, or as a member, yes, as a member of the GAC, I have not heard anything from the GAC leadership about this webinar. I have not heard anything about the Secretariat of GAC or ICANN Secretariat associated to GAC about this webinar. If there is any webinar on this issue about the SOAC to prepare their work, it should be very well announced. And in fact, yeah, as far as the GAC is concerned, it's not only the chair of the GAC, perhaps invitation should be with at least the leadership of the GAC, because unfortunately, we, unlike the other people, always decide when we are in session. So our decision will be ICANN 61. Therefore, the best approach would be to have any face-to-face meeting in ICANN 62. This information of selection or proposal of candidate is very important one, and this group is very important group. Therefore, let's be quite careful about that. Thank you.
Caboose, thank you. It's David McCauley speaking again for the record. I tend to agree with you often, Caboose. I slightly disagree in this respect. My hope, my very strong hope, is that there must be a way found to have a face-to-face at ICANN 61, if at all possible. I very much appreciate the comments Bernie made about there may be some time in the context of the Workstream 2 accountability face-to-face meeting. And so I would encourage you, Liz, and I'll give you a chance to react to what Caboose is saying and what I'm saying. I encourage you, Liz, and staff to bend every effort to make sure that if there is desire on the part of the SOs and ACs, and I can't imagine that there wouldn't be, to get together, that we find a way to do it. This IRP, standing up the standing panel, is one of those important legs that I've spoken to about empowering the new IRP. It's in the bylaws. It's something that we have been speaking about deliberatively as we consider public comments on rules. But this is another leg, and it's critical. I personally think, and I think as leader of this group, that we should do anything we can to help move along the process to establishing and fulfilling the bylaws mandate for a responsible IRP process, including panel, rules, et cetera. So if there's any way, if a meeting is called for, if there's any way to do it, and I'm happy to help think this through if you would like, let's do it. I do have a couple comments, Liz, before I ask you to react. I see your hand, and I'll come to you in just a minute. I do have a couple comments of my own, and that is with respect to the standing panel, that the provisions for establishing it are under bylaw 4.3J. And if you go through there, you'll see that the IOT really doesn't have a formal role with respect to establishing the standing panel. The bylaw does mention us with respect to tendering for secretariat services and things of that nature. But there is, to me, a subtext to the IOT involvement, and that is what Caboose was just mentioning. Those of us on this team also participate in ICANN in other contexts. I myself participate in the Registry Stakeholder Group, in the CCNSO, and I've been getting contacts about the webinar, and I'm being asked by people to be involved in their context. And so all of us, I think, are going to see this, and I encourage us as members of the IOT who have developed some knowledge of Bylaw 4.3 to help our constituencies. As Caboose was saying, he can help the GAC, and we can all help our constituencies as they participate in the CCNSO, in the GNSO, or whatever it might be. And so that's an encouragement to all of us to be involved in this process. And so I plan on participating in the webinar next week. Anyway, I'm going to give a chance now to Liz to react to what I said and what Caboose said. So, Liz, the floor is yours.
Thank you, David, and thank you to you and Bernie for the suggestion in terms of carving time during ICANN 61 for the work stream 2 if we needed to make this meeting happen. And we will definitely work with the group, the SOs and AC leaders, and try and find schedule a time to make a face-to-face happen, if that's so, what everyone, how they wish to proceed during 61, and the suggestion to also save time for 62 in the event that we need it is also something that we will take back with us. I also want to respond to Cavusa's comment about the info about the webinar. We worked with our policy team to reach out to the SONAC leaders, so an email was sent to the SONAC leaders about the webinar. I think we are entrusting that the SONAC leaders will decide and who from their group should or attend the webinar info. So, and again, as I indicated, this webinar is intended to be a kick off the conversation and answer any questions that the SONACs may have about this process, because it's the first time that such a coordination across SONACs has been done that I know of. So, it doesn't mean that this is the only conversation until we get to 61 or whatever the appropriate face-to-face time will be. It's just a launching point. And so there could be, if they so require, there may be other conversations that happens along the way in order to help the SOs and ACs develop this process to fit their needs and as appropriate. So again, like I said, this is just a beginning point, and a lot of what happens and the number of meetings and how much time is needed in a face-to-face will be driven by the SOs and ACs.
Thank you, Liz. David McCauley speaking again. If there are nothing further on the standing panel preparations, that is the SOAC preparations, let's move on to agenda item number 3. And Brenda, could I ask you just to put on the screen the sign-up sheet? And I've asked to have this put up just to show it. I'm going to speak to it briefly, and I'm going to use it as a catalyst to speak about bringing the process of considering the public comments on the draft rules, bringing that process to a close. So there's our sign-up sheet. At the top, under the first yellow heading, are the groupings of the various comments. And then you can see the columns going across in first reading and second reading. And this matrix or spreadsheet, whatever you want to call it, was something that I believe Bernie or I first created, but it was put in decent shape, I think, by Bernie. Or maybe by Brenda, I can't remember who, but I took a stab at something. It was fairly rough, and this now looks much better. The second yellow heading on the left-hand column is simply for things that are left for us to do following getting these rules done. And unstated in there is this informal role we have with respect to establishing the standing panel. But you'll see in the green parts on the right two columns that I have been a little bit less than administratively skillful in keeping that up to date, because we have moved some of these past first reading that are not indicated as such. And so what I'm going to say now is that it's my intent in the next 2 weeks to do two things. One is to bring this matrix up to date, and two is to begin drafting a final report from us on our consideration of the public comments. And that report is something that I will, of course, put in front of our group, and the purpose of putting it in front of our group will be itself twofold. One, to drive to conclusion those issues where we still have some outstanding issues amongst us, and two, to come up with a final report that we all agree is a fair final report. So it's going to be a multi-purpose document. It's not going to be the final report, but it's now going to be the context in which we drive to closure. At least that's my expectation. And I'm guessing that's going to take me 2 to 3 weeks to do that. And so later in the meeting, I'll ask Bernie to talk about the next date, and that will sort of feed into that discussion. Having said that, I mentioned a couple of things that I haven't indicated on that matrix. One has to do with discussions on joinder and ongoing monitoring, which we have had in the last few calls, but I didn't come to the list to close those the way I said I would, and I apologize for that. I had a little bit of a, well, it doesn't matter. I just was unable to do it. And so I see that Aubrey's on the phone now. I'm going to, before we move on to agenda item 4, I'm going to ask Aubrey if she wishes to say anything about ongoing monitoring. But I believe that I can come to an acceptable position based on the discussions that we've had heretofore with Aubrey and myself and others. And then on Joinder, I think we've also, especially with respect to comments from Malcolm and Liz, I think we've actually gotten to a position where I can state something that we can agree on. And so that'll be in this draft final report that I'm talking about. But that's what I envision as the process going forward. And so I will now say to folks, please, if you have questions or comments, get ready to make them. But first I'll ask Aubrey if she would like to say anything about ongoing monitoring, or if Aubrey, if you would prefer me just to plow ahead the way I just proposed.
I'm fine with you plowing. This is Aubrey speaking, sorry. I'm fine with you plowing ahead. I think we've gotten close to the compromise point, but I don't think we've written it down in a way that both you and I thought it was there. So certainly plow ahead and certainly drag me in as you find, sorry.
Thank you, Aubrey. And that's exactly what I intend to do with respect to this final draft. It won't be, quote, final. It will be a way to close the actual language where we've probably reached compromise on this and other issues. So thank you very much for that. And if there are no other comments, we can move to the next parts of the agenda. Agenda items number 4 and 5 are additional substantive discussions on a couple of issues that we've touched on, but we haven't discussed to the extent that we've discussed some of the others. And that's why in this past week or 8 or 9 days, I put out a couple of emails. Thank you, Brenda, for putting one of them up. The first one I'd like to speak about is types of hearings, because we got 5 specific comments from the public on types of hearings, and they sort of go around issues with respect to draft procedure number 5 in the draft procedures that we came up with when Becky was leading our group. The comments are from Dot Music, from the business constituency of the GNSO, from the non-commercial stakeholder group of the GNSO, from the International Trademark Association, and from an individual, Richard Hill. And you saw in my email that I sort of laid out what I thought were the bylaws, the fundamental bylaws principles underlying this area. And I spoke about bylaw 4.3A, which says that one of the purposes of IRP is to secure accessible, transparent, efficient, consistent, coherent, and just resolution of disputes. There's a later purpose of the IRP bylaw. I didn't mention it, but talked about timeliness. And so these fundamental principles sort of underlie where we should go with these. You've been able to take a look at the comments from these 5 people that I put in the mail, and then I came out on the list and said, I don't believe that we need to really make any change here. The one thing that, let me put it this way, I agreed with Richard Hill's comment. Following my email, Malcolm, and I'm sorry that Malcolm's not in the call because I was hoping he would summarize his comments, but Malcolm came out on the list, and Cavus came out on the list, and Cavus, I believe, supported my idea that the current text is adequate. Malcolm felt that current Rule 5 could do with some changes in fairly detailed specifics, and he was kind enough to put up a straw man. And I have read it and I've considered it. In my opinion, and this is my opinion as a participant, of course, I am unmoved. I mean, I remain where I was and where Cavus suggested we should be. And when I looked at the purposes of the IRP in Section 4.3A, I'm still struck by the idea that this is supposed to be efficient, et cetera. The draft supplementary rule number 5, does have, in my opinion, it does have adequate instruction to the panel. I think one of Malcolm's concern was it was too opaque. But frankly, in these kinds of matters, I think that's not unusual. Part of what Rule 5 currently says, IRP panel should conduct its proceedings with the presumption that in-person hearings are not permitted. The presumption against in-person hearings may be rebutted only under extraordinary circumstances where, upon motion by a party, the panel determines that the party seeking an in-person hearing has demonstrated that it's necessary for fairness, that it's necessary to further the purposes of the IRP, and that considerations of fairness and furtherance of the purposes of the IRP outweigh the countervailing considerations. I actually think that's a fair statement. And I do agree that Malcolm did us a great turn by drafting a suggested straw man, but I personally would say of the straw man, it too has some opaque areas, and it too is extraordinarily detailed. Now, it may be somewhat unfair. I have to give Malcolm a chance to come back on the list, but I remain unmoved and believe that Rule 5 is adequate as stated. So that's a long way of saying that's where my position is as a participant. If anyone else has a comment, please come on in, and I see Caboose, your hand is up. You have the floor.
Yes, David. As I mentioned, this type of activities, having a panel, is not a specificity of the ICANN. There are other institutions, international institutions, they have similar type of panels. Usually these type of panels are to be left independent, not biased by in-person hearing, obligatory and mandatory. However, you have put sufficient flexibility that if they decide that there is a need to in-person hearing, they do that. But we don't want that should be a standard alone, that every issue would have a in-person hearing, and I don't know when we say in-person hearing is a singular or in-person hearing is a plural, whether two or three or five people on behalf of one particular party who comes, and each of which discuss and bias the thinking of the member of the board, or not board, member of the panel, and so on. So I am not in favor of any change at all. We have discussed it sufficiently for hours and hours and hours. And this is something that is flexible, give a latitude, and we want to retain that. We are not in favor of any change. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caboose. Liz, you have the floor now.
Thank you, David. I just wanted to state ICANN's position for the record. We are in agreement with you and also Caboose in that the rule should stay as drafted. This is an issue that was discussed at length previously, as Caboose alluded to, and including the discussion of in-person hearing, live witness testimony or not. And so we don't really see a need for it to be rediscussed at this point. We do want to address, it seems to be that Malcolm's suggestion is based upon the premise that live witness there should be live witness testimony, because without so there would not be a fair hearing. But we haven't seen any evidence to support this, and on the contrary, the evidence in terms of a practitioner standpoint is flies in the face of this, because there are many dispute mechanisms where live witness testimony is not a part of the hearing, and that doesn't mean that it isn't a fair hearing. It actually has become an increasing practice in many arbitration or dispute resolution proceedings where live witness testimony is offered by written witness statements that submitted ahead of time. And there are many advantages to doing this. For example, it would provide, would allow witnesses to provide testimony without traveling to a hearing, and it makes it easier to obtain the testimony because the witnesses can prepare ahead of time, and it would be less disruptive to the witnesses or executives in terms of their normal day-to-day functions. I also know that we have, in the past when this was discussed, shared the extraordinary cost in cases where we've had IRP hearings where there were live witness testimony, and there were two instances, as I believe it was Amy Stathis that shared this in 2016, and it was over $1 million because of live witness testimony. In one instance, it was over $2 million. And I think it goes to, it's not just that this is about cost, but it's just about, it's about efficiency and expediency, as you pointed out. And, you know, we're talking about expending a lot of money into a hearing to have live witness testimonies when there is no benefit to that, that couldn't be dealt with in terms of written statements. It's about money that then ICANN would expend and would take less away from the money that ICANN can use to serve its mission, because they would be funneling this extraordinary cost into the IRP. And those are, I think, some of the things that were discussed and why we decided to keep, to go with the current draft rules. And then also the one other thing I wanted to mention, I think, was there was a discussion of what we should put in the current draft rule for the deadline for exchange of witness statements and evidence before a hearing. And for that, we would propose perhaps a 15-day deadline in advance of the hearing for the exchange.
Thank you, Liz. David McCauley again for the record. I think that's the same number I was suggesting, so that thank you for that suggestion. And I think that we should do that. We'll settle on 15 days. We're talking calendar days, I believe, not business days. And so thank you for that. And that's in the final draft what I will throw in there, barring other comments. Let me just ask you a question based on what you just said, and that is, when you talked about the $1 million and $2 million experiences, were those live witness testimonies electronic? Like, were they virtual testimony where someone was speaking over the internet, or were they somewhere in a venue somewhere?
I believe that there were different panelists located in different places. I think one was in one venue, but no, let me refresh my recollection of this. Actually, they were live witness testimonies.
Okay, but they were done electronically where participants were in different cities. I mean, people didn't travel to go and testify, did they?
No, I think they did.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, thank you. Interesting history. Caboose, your hand is up. You have the floor.
Yes, I just wanted to also agree with the 15 days, calendar days that you have proposed. I've already mentioned in the mailing list, so I think that should be an easy way to proceed with that. So I wanted to mention that. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. And the discussion about this underscores something. I'm going to ask you to bear with me for a minute. It underscores the importance of establishing the standing panel that we spoke about earlier, and again raises this idea of encouraging all of us who have developed some knowledge of the IRP process to help our various constituencies. And the reason I say that, one of the reasons, is it's very clear from this discussion that IRP panels are going to be wrestling with questions of some important financial consequence to people. And so it's in our interest and ICANN community interest that the panel that's established initially and then ongoing in the future is an experienced, mature, responsible panel. And so it's in all of our interest to bend every effort to do this. This is not going to be easy work. And another consideration is, as they issue rulings, I mean, we're talking here about procedural rulings, and so, you know, that's one thing. But as they issue rulings, these rulings take precedent under the new bylaw. And so it's very important. The first panel is going to have an outsized influence. And so, again, I, as a participant in this whole process, I'm just encouraging all of us to help our constituencies, to help ICANN, to help the SOs and the EACs get this done right. And so to get involved and to help in this process. Okay, enough said. Thank you for letting me go on about that. And we can next turn to agenda item number 5, which is another substantive issue dealing with challenges to consensus policies. And, excuse me, this, as I pointed out, this is an email that I just sent, I guess, earlier this week. And this series of comments on challenges to consensus policy came from the non-commercial stakeholder group of the GNSO and from a law firm. Basically, the statement of the non-commercial stakeholder group, the gist of it was that IRP panels should send invalidated portions of consensus policies back to ICANN, which should send it back to the SO that created it. And I honestly think it's a valid comment, but I think it's consistent with the way the procedures currently work. And so I don't think there's anything that we need to do as a consequence of the comment. That's my personal take on it. Then the law firm Fletcher, Held, and Hildreth commented on 3 sections. One was on notice, and I thought their comment with respect to notice, as I discuss in my email, was fair enough. I mean, you have to have notice to people that are where you're, you know, with respect to a challenge to consensus policy. And in my mind, that notice needs to be to the leadership of the SO or SOs that were engaged in constructing the policy to begin with. But the law firm went on and said that the notice should go to constituent bodies that make up the SO. And indeed, people that might be affected by the change. And my personal comment is that's just not really called for. We're talking about ICANN's IRP and the people who are going to be involved in the IRP. And my personal take on it was that notice to SO leadership would be sufficient. They secondly commented on a mandatory right of intervention. And again, I thought it was a fair comment with respect to the SOs that constructed the policy, but thought that the mandatory right of intervention should not go beyond the SO. And finally, they had suggestions on limits on panel action when they overturned consensus policy, where they made 4 specific suggestions. And I'll read those. It won't take long. My suggestion was we not take these up, but the suggestions were for the IRP panel to identify specific portions of consensus policy that it found was violating an article or bylaw, to indicate what portions of the policy are not violated, 3, remand the consensus policy to the ICANN board for review with the SO, and 4, indicate whether the panel recommends that the consensus policy should be suspended pending board and SO review, rewriting, etc. And my take on that was that the bylaws provide for the panel to decide whether an action or an inaction by the board or the staff violated the articles or the bylaws, and that's period. What happens next is up to the ICANN community involved, the board, the SO, whatever it is, that's going to be wrapped up in this. And so that was my take on it, and I thought we should just stick with the bylaws and the rules as written. It's not an unfair comment, but that my take on it was just a little bit different. And I appreciate, by the way, all the comments, all the public comments we've got. They're all very thoughtful from people that have a serious interest in this. So that's what I propose for treatment on these, and I'm asking if anybody would like to raise their hand, make a point or a comment. And I should mention, as you know, Malcolm came on the list on this as well. I believe that he basically agreed. He finished his comments by saying, I think this comment is really addressed to the question of whether the board is entitled to adopt CCTL policy or GTL the policy outside or in conflict with respective PDPs, including by adopting a policy that varies from a PDP outcome. It seems there is a good case that rewriting a PDP policy in such fashion would itself be a violation of Article 10, etc. I think it's outside the scope of the rules of procedure to assert this, and so largely agreeing with what I said. That said, if anyone would like to take it further, make another suggestion, agree with either of these comments, please take the floor now. seeing or hearing none. Whoops, I'm sorry. Kavush, you have a hand up, so please take the floor.
Yes, David. I didn't follow what you said about the PDP and the consistencies or inconsistencies with the bylaw. Are you talking that when preparing the PDP, they should be consistent with the bylaw, or you're talking something else? I heard something, maybe I misunderstood. Could you kindly clarify the matter? What was the issue of the PDP and the consistencies or conformity with the bylaw? Could you kindly explore that a little bit more? Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. What I was suggesting, and I think Malcolm agrees with this, although you should read his email, but what I was suggesting is that on challenges to consensus policy that result from a PDP, we should not get into the specific four recommendations that came from the law firm Fletcher Held and Hildreth, I think it is. We should not get down to that level of specificity, but rather honor the bylaw provision that says that what an IRP panel will do when it renders its decision is decide whether or not an action or inaction by the staff or board violates an article or bylaw, or an article or bylaw. That's really what the panel's empowered to do. That's all they can do. Now, they can certainly give their reasons, but at the end of the day, the effect of their decision, as I understand it under the bylaws, will be that they have decided that an action or inaction, in this case honoring a consensus policy, is violating or not the bylaws or articles. That's really it. And the consequences of that announcement will not be up to the panel, but up to the ICANN community involved, the board, the SO, or whatever, you know, whoever takes this up to try and shape what comes next in light of that announcement from the panel. Does that help, Caboose?
Yes, it helps, and I fully agree with the way that you have described that. Thank you.
Thank you. Liz, you have a hand up, so you have the floor.
Thanks, David. I wanted to respond to an issue that was raised on list about notice. I think it may have come from Malcolm as to who should provide the notice, and I think it was suggested that it would be the procedures officer. And I think in this instance, it seems to us that there are many instances in which if the idea of notice is to provide it promptly, I don't know that the procedure officers is the right person to be designated in this role, because oftentimes it would be, I mean, it would really be the claimant who would know what claims are being challenged when the claimant is filing the IRP. And so it should really, from ICANN's standpoint, the onus should be on the claimant to provide the notice. In many instances, a claimant could initiate an IRP, but, for example, even ICANN, and then let alone a procedures officer who's further removed from the initiation process. But ICANN wouldn't be aware of the IRP having been initiated until the IRP, the filing has been perfected. And we've had instances where that has happened where the IRP filing never got perfected. So in that instance, for example, the procedure officer wouldn't even be aware of it. I think what we can do is ICANN could develop some kind of an email list that we can put up on the IRP page that a claimant can go to in terms of if they are challenging, say, a policy that was developed by X group, they can see who it is they can provide notice to. But it seems appropriate that notice should be provided by the claimant.
Thank you, Liz. That makes sense. So when I do up the final report, I'll come back and relook at your comment. It makes some sense and try and take that into account. So without further hands, we have run through the substance of the agenda. We're now to the AOB portion. I'm going to ask Bernie if he would pardon me, if he would mention when our next meeting is, and that will be the time that I'm trying to drive this draft towards. So, Bernie, I'm going to ask you to go ahead, and then Caboose, I'll come to you. I see your hands up. Excuse me.
Thank you, sir. We've got a tentative slot of, say, February 1st, 1900 on the books, and so if that's convenient, we will confirm that at this meeting.
Thank you, Bernie. And if it's, could I also ask you after the call's over to try and get the same time slot a week later on the 8th? Just in case I'm having a struggle to getting the draft done in time. But, you know, better to have and not need kind of thinking. And
done.
Then, thanks, Bernie. I will ask Caboose to take the floor then.
Yes, David. I put in the chat two times that I raised some questions or some inquiry or some requests, and I hope that that will be responded. I ask that I receive a copy of the letter sent to the SO and AC with respect to their preparation, with respect to what we expect from them, what the scope of the work before them, perhaps, at least I don't have it, I need to have that one, and that is a few other small questions I raised. I don't want to take up the floor at this time, you want to put it end to the meeting, but please kindly ask the secretariat or Liz to read that and provide me the information that I have asked. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. And yes, I have not been following the chat too much. Pardon me, but Liz, could you get those sent to Caboose, or at least the what he was asking for? And I know specifically that includes the mail about the webinar, I believe.
Sorry, David. Yes, happy to.
Oh, I see. Well, thank you, and I believe that brings us to the end, so we may get out of here early. I'll give one last chance if someone would like to make a comment or suggestion or anything like that relative to what we've been speaking about or future plans. Seeing or hearing none, I want to thank you all. Thanks, Bernie and Brenda, for help beforehand, and Shireen, thank you very much for attending. If you would like to make a comment, you're certainly welcome to.
Thank you. Have a good night.
David, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Shireen.
I was just going to say, I just want to say really good progress on the supplementary procedures and the types of hearing and challenges to the consensus policies. Concern about the standing panel that the process is not yet agreed between the role of the SOs and ACs, ICANN, OLG, and the board. So this is probably going to take longer than one would like, but if we can progress that as soon as possible, I know the webinar might help in the face-to-face meeting, but hopefully this will get moving as well. But everywhere else, excellent progress. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Shireen, for your interest in this, and best wishes to all on this phone call, and that's a wrap. We're done. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.